Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, risk and return. Before we get to the main event, a look at the markets, a really strong day up, really good. And as you can see, as far as if you're a bull, this is a great day. I was still in bear territory, and I'm getting killed. Irritates me to no end. Now, you notice the classic pattern. The Dow, the safest, are up almost 1%. The S&P 500 is up more than 1% or 1.33%, and the NASDAQ is just roaring up well over 2%. So there you go, that classic risk and return kind of relationship, and we're going to talk a lot about that today and on Friday as well. Now, crude oil is actually kind of surprising me. There is a story that's going around. I called yesterday. I said, what the heck is it with crude not coming back up? There's a belief that the Russian oil is going to keep flowing. They said it's a showpiece. The oil supply is not going to be reduced at all. Whether or not that rumor is true, I can't get it confirmed one way or the other. But if we don't have an upsurge in the amount, a cut in the supply of oil, then we'll see oil prices coming back down, and eventually gas prices will come back down with them. Going over here, the metals are getting killed, and bonds, the yield's going up, so the price is going down. So investors are getting out of the metals, they're getting out of the bonds, and they are going to the equities. This is the reverse flight to quality. They're moving away from the safety, and they're sticking their heads up above water. Now, look at the S&P 500 just to see what the volume is telling us. The volume is awfully weak, though. This is a strong up day, but you see that we're more than halfway through the day, and we've got a volume of 1.3 billion shares, and the average day overall over the past year has been 3.7 billion shares. So this is not a wide buying spree. It's a narrow buying spree, but it is strongly on the bull side. So there you are on that. Good news for what it's worth, even though it's a lot of the heavies are still staying off the playing field and just waiting to see what happens next. If we come over here, get back over here to the, getting back over here. London had a good day, up almost, 1.75%. I think they're still trading a little bit. And then Nikkei, it had a strong morning, and then it kind of flattened out. There was a little surge there at the end. You can see on the Spark chart there. But the surge was this morning. Generally, it's all about rumors, wars and rumors of wars and all of that. Talk about something is going to happen as far as the Ukrainian situation is concerned. What it is, I don't know. There's talk that Putin is going to be overthrown, but those rumors are probably not true. But there is a general sentiment that Russia is running out of steam, and it is getting to be a slog, sort of like Afghanistan in high speed form. So there may be a relatively quick end to this ungodly nightmare that the Ukrainians are going through right now. But one way or the other, markets are feeling very frisky. Bull sentiment is all over the place. However, looking over here at the yield curve, I showed it to you before. Do you see that on the 11th, the yield curve inverted with the 7-year at 2.01% and the 10-year just a notch below, one basis point below at 2. And it is still holding as of yesterday. Yesterday, the 7-year was still above the 10-year. So this wasn't a fluke. This is the real deal. This is an inversion. Now it may revert itself. Now it may right itself, but once it has inverted, and it has clearly shown that that inversion was not just a quick thing that happened, yeah, we're probably looking at a recession. I put it up on my LinkedIn page so that folks could see that. So far, I got a couple of nasty private messages, but mostly it's been favorable. We'll see how it goes. Now, let me take you over here. I'm going to give me a second here, make sure that I... Yeah. Now, I've talked about risk on a number of occasions here, and I'm trying to build you up for now the formal introduction to risk, the measures we do of risk, and all of those good parts of the numerical side of it. The book tells you risk in terms of severity, but that's not exactly right. For one thing, as I've said before, we can measure risk or we can describe risk. Qualitatively, risk is that OMG factor or that, oh, no, I don't want to do this. But risk can have other dimensions. There are some risks that are more long-term. There are risks that are short-term. There's risk that you don't have to have. There's risk that you can take if you're just a stupid mofo or a crazy person. But then we have to narrow down what we consider to be risk in finance. And this pervades our study, and it also does as far as many other parts of business is concerned. Whether a business says the word risk or not, it is always on our minds. What risk is involved? Well, let's talk about risk. Risk is variation of outcomes. Risk is variation of outcomes. In other words, how many different outcomes could there be? But it's a little more than that because risk could have another dimension to it. If all those risks are in a tight area, okay, this stock could go up by 0.5%, it could go down by 0.5%, could go up by 0.25%, could go down by 0.25%. That's not really too much of a risk. In other words, the clustering of the risk is important too. How wide are the possibilities? And how likely are the possibilities? This gets us into a couple of different areas here. There is the spread of possibilities. If it could go up or down by a large amount, a stock, well, that is considered risky. But if those are not common to happen, we have to think about that, is that really as risky as we want? So here's the first thing that we have to talk about, and this is something that if you are in the RMI major, the risk management and insurance, they emphasize right away, frequency versus severity of risk. Frequency versus severity of risk. Let me show you, give you a demonstration. Sir, could you please come up here for a minute? What are these?
Toy chickens.
They are not toy chickens. They're small chickens. Toy chickens, my. This is a lot of chickens. Okay. You got attacked by a lot of chickens. Frequency was high. Did you get hurt?
No.
Of course not. Now, suppose that you have a chicken dragon. Wait. Fire breathing, chicken dragon. Oh, God! Ow. Frequency is very... How many times in your life have you had a chicken dragon that was a fire breathing chicken? God, a fire breathing chicken dragon attack you. Severity is high. I mean, you're going to get chicken dragon with fire. We'll both barbecue. But it's very infrequent. So in other words, the frequency is low, but the severity is high. Whereas with those little chickens, the frequency was high, but the severity was low. You get the difference. You understand the difference between risk, and, rather frequency and severity? Yes, sir. Thank you. You're sitting there, the hell did I just see? Okay. And this is actually something that we have to consider, too, is, for example, in a side story about the attacks on the United States on the September 11th of 2001 was that the two towers that were hit in New York City, I mean, you should insure them against something like that happening. Even though it's ridiculously small, the chance that it ever will. So what did they do? One of the towers was insured because the chance of that happening is extremely small, but what would possibly be the chance that both towers would be hit by some catastrophe? It was nil, so there was insurance on only one of them from what the stories go. In other words, frequency was extremely low, so they took a chance on it. One time, I picked up a hitchhiker, and he was very grateful. He said, you know, I really appreciate this, man. You know, you don't know. I could have been a serial killer. And I said, well, what would be the chance that there would be two serial killers in the same car? He asked to get off at the next exit. Moving along. We in finance need to quantify risk. We need to put numbers. As I've said before, we need to liquidate risk. There's a company down in St. Louis. I took a group of my finance club students down there more than a few years ago, and it was an insurance company. It was a commercial. It was known as a personal lines carrier, but it did a lot of big commercial stuff. And they were offering jobs and internships to all of my students. They said, we want you. What you'll do is finance. You're going to go out and you are going to price risk. And he said, let me explain. One day you might be walking on a barge and assessing the risks on that barge. Another day you might be 10 stories up on the skeleton of a building looking at the electrical systems and pricing the risk. In other words, we need to know how much risk there is, what its cost is, what the frequency and severity is of each of the identified risks, make those into dollar values, add them up, the expected value of the loss, and that's how we determine insurance premiums for these kinds of commercial enterprises. It was kind of the kind of cool work that you're in the office doing Excel spreadsheets some days, but other days you're out, you don't know where the hell you're going to go. And, of course, no one wanted a job because it was in St. Louis and everyone wanted to be back in Chicago. So there's that. But anyway, you see, we need to be able to assess a number on risk. Generally speaking, we in stocks and bonds and securities, we look at the variation in price. But we can't stop there. You see, there's a big difference between a stock that's $10 going up or down by a dollar and a stock that's $100 going up or down by a dollar. So we have to change these into percentages so that it's always apples to apples we're measuring. So when I talk about this number, you probably figure I'm talking about a percentage change, not an absolute change. And that way we can compare different scales of operation or scales of pricing so that we can compare the price of, let's say, a stock like Amazon, which is insanely high, with the price of something that is a more modest price like U.S. Steel, which has a surprisingly low price. Getting on from that, what do we do for numbers? Well, the classic, and you learned this before, is we should probably try a standard deviation. That'll be our first attack on measuring the spread of possible outcomes. That's risk, the spread of possible outcomes. Now, we're going to have to refine it. I've already talked to you about how we refine it. We turn standard deviations into something called beta. But just taking standard deviations for a minute, the first thing you always have to do with a standard deviation is get the expected value of it. The expected value, and I'll do random variable, is going to be the sum from I equals 1 to n observations of the probability of each outcome times the value of each outcome. So with stocks and stock returns, that would be, we would say, the expected value of the price of the stock would be the sum from I equals 1 to n of the probability of each stock price times the stock price. We just go through a historical line of data and just add them up and put probabilities. Now, here's the important part. In general, the probabilities might not be the same. But in practice, if you have a number of observations and they all have the same likelihood of outcome, which would be 1 over the number of observations, and this breaks down to the sum from I equals 1 to n of over n. Datum of and divide, an average. The fancy word for this is an expected value. Just add them up and divide. Nothing hard about that. Some of the homework questions are just that. Do be cautious, though, because in real life, and I've actually done this, sometimes we're looking at something like this, and here's some numbers right now. GDP and very bad, bad, and on the other side, good, very good, and there in the middle, we might have something like, meh. Very bad, we have a negative 5.0% GDP for the quarter, for the last quarter. Bad, we'd have a negative 2%. Whatever. Maybe a 1% up. Good, a 2.0%. And very good, a 4%. And the probabilities, let's say this has a probability of 0.15. This one has a probability of 0.20. And on this side, we have a probability. In the middle, we have a 0.25. And then, let me write over here. And then, oops. Now, those will add up to 1. I'm talking in fancy terms. The metric of the space is 1. All probability distributions add up to 1. So then the expected value of GDP would be negative 5.0% times 0.15 plus negative 2.0% times 0.20 plus 1% times 0.30 plus 0.4%. What did I do there? No, that's a 2%. Whoa. I screwed up. 1% was the 0.25. There's the problem. 0.25, and then a 2% up has a probability of 0.30, and a 4% up has a probability of 0.10. That would be the expected value. And if I crank that out very quickly, I would have negative 5 times 0.15 plus negative 2. Whoops, I screwed that up. Let me do that again. Negative 5. 5.0 times 0.15. Got to pay attention to what I'm doing here. Plus negative 2 times 0.20 plus 1.0 times 0.25 plus 2.0 times 0.3 plus 4% times 0.10. Okay, make sure I did that right. Yep, right there I messed up. I didn't put a point in there. A point. Yeah, I think I did it. Is that right? Huh. So the expected value, in other words, our best guess at where it's going to land is at 0.1% for the GDP. So this is our measure of central tendency, where we think it's going to land. Does that mean that's where it's going to land? No. That means that that is the best guess. If someone said, give me a number, we would give them that number. However, you notice that that is not a symmetric distribution. You see how it is actually kind of tilted toward the positive side. Do you see that there's more probability above the middle than there is below it? A little bit more. And that's why you've got that slightly positive expected value. Let me show you something here. I'm going to pull up, and I think I did this before with you, but it's one of those stupid pet tricks in Excel that's worth knowing. If I get that data back in there, GDP and probability, we would have negative 5% with a probability of 0.15. We'd have, well, let me run those down. Negative 2, negative 1, negative 2%. Positive 1.0%. 2%. 2.0%. And 4%. And then, taking it over here, the probabilities were 0.2, 0.25, 0.3, and 0.1. Okay, so now, here's the stupid pet trick that I can do. If I wanted to take the first column times the second column, add them up, I can use sum product equals sum prod oct of that column by that column. And then format that as a percentage. And we get the same answer we got before. Just a quick way to do these kinds of problems where you don't have a symmetric distribution. Now the next one, and I'm going to keep this up here because there's something you can use as sum product in a lot of very fun ways. Fun. But look, the next thing that we would want to do is measure, this is central tendency. The next one is variation, the spread of the data. And that one, we use sigma squared. And that is the sum of the probability of I times each data point minus the expected value squared. Yes. Say that again. Oh, for that one right there? It's each data point minus the average. So each data point, I take each data point again and subtract off this average. Each data point, and square it, multiply by the probability. It's a pain in the butt. However, you can make it a lot easier. I can do the sum product again. First thing I'm going to do is say, this equals each data point minus the expected value. And I'm going to make that an absolute reference, so when I sweep it down, it doesn't change this cell reference. Squared. And then I can just roll those all down, get all those numbers. And then I can do equals sum product of the probabilities times at each data point, comma, times each of those square things. The main reason I'm doing this, and it is a little bit kind of off the beaten track, but this is so useful for a lot of things. When you've got to multiply this times this times a whole row of data, well, you can use some product to save yourself some pretty serious time. Especially, imagine if I had like 50 entries in columns 2 through 51. That would be a real time saver to use a sum product. Now, this is the average or the mean. Well, let me call it the mean. That's a fancy word for it, the mean. This is the variance. And then the one that we want is the standard deviation, which is the square root of the variance. Now, we use the standard deviation and not the variance for a couple of reasons. Let me show you. What? Why did I get a negative variance? Did I square each of those? Did I? Okay, let me do that again. Equals sum product, talking and chewing gum. I could do these beforehand, but I want to have you see me do it and actually then get the that one. Nope. Each data point minus the mean as an absolute reference squared. There. That's better. Okay, now format that. And that's a percentage. The reason, again, notice that the reason I'm doing that, taking the standard deviation instead of just looking at the variance, is because the standard deviation will be in the original units of the data points. That's why we do standard deviations, because the result is in the original units of the data points. And so now I can say, well, the expected value is 0.1%. That has a spread of 0.5%. Now, what does that spread mean? If it's a normal distribution, the spread tells us something kind of useful. It tells us that 67% of the time, the spread will be from one standard deviation below negative one to one standard deviation above. So we would take the standard deviation, we would take the mean minus one standard deviation I am not batting 1,000 today. This mean minus one standard deviation I'm going to get it here the mean I am not batting 1,000 here. The mean minus a standard deviation to the mean plus a standard deviation. Yeah, that's what I thought. Equals the mean minus the standard deviation. Why does it keep wanting to do that? I don't know why. Equals the mean minus the standard deviation. I guess that's right. It doesn't look right. To the mean plus a standard deviation. It just doesn't look right. But all of that, that's kind of this formula right here. If a distribution is symmetric, it just doesn't look right, that number, but I mean the formula is symmetric. Then 67% of the time, the actual value will be between the mean minus one standard deviation and the mean plus one standard deviation. about 94-95% of the time, it will be the actual value will be between the mean minus two standard deviations and the mean plus two standard deviations. That's useful to us because, in other words, I can say, okay, I am 94% confident that the average, that the actual value is going to be somewhere between 0.1 minus 0.5 and 0.1 plus 0.5. I'm 67% confident that, no. Yeah. It's just something that, it's not in the book, and I would not ask you this on a test, but that's why we care about the standard deviation. It tells us how likely we are to be within certain limits. Like, and I'll give you a good example of this, and actually I have one. I have the sheet. The average over the last 5 years for my company's revenues was this much over the past 5 years. It was, that's rounded. It was actually a little bit a messy number. But the standard deviation was $3,100. That was useful. That's useful to me to know that because I know that 67% chance the revenues will be somewhere between $12,500 minus $3,100 and $12,500 plus $3,100. I 67% of the time, I know it'll be there somewhere. So in other words, in the coming season, if everything is about the same as it has been, then I will be somewhere between 15,000. Well, let me put it on the bottom side here. Will be between $9,400 and $15,600. 67% chance that I'll be in there somewhere. There'd be a 94-95% chance that it'd be somewhere between $12,500 minus $6,200 and $12,500 plus $6,200. Two standard deviations. So, actually, that kind of sucks, 6,300. So I have a 94% chance that I'll be somewhere between $6,300 and $18,700. That's one of those useful things in business for planning. For one thing, it tells me what kinds of expenditures that I can make. Well, if I've got something that's going to cost me $5,000 and I want to be 95% sure that I'm going to be able to make it for the year, I'm 94% sure that I'll be okay spending $5,000 on new equipment and stuff like that. But if I want to spend, like, let's say $7,000, there's no way I would do that. I'm 94% sure I won't make it. I'll be in negative territory this coming year. That's something to keep in mind for these for business planning. And if you haven't seen this yet, I imagine that they will show you something like this in a management science course. But let me take that off the board. I want to get away from the numbers. We can do the numbers on calculators, spreadsheets, and all of that very easily. And I think I mentioned this before. Total risk. This is what sigma measures. This is what standard deviation measures. Now, it has gotten to be popular in the last 5 years or so for textbooks to use the term standalone risk. This is the total risk that you take on in any kind of a business. But there are two pieces to this. There is, and I'll use a couple of different words for this, company risk and macroeconomy risk. The company risk is what is unusual about that company. What in that company creates risk that is not the overall economy doing it. This other risk is the whole economy and how this company varies in its performance based upon the whole economy. Another word you see for this company risk is peculiar or pecuniary or diversifiable. Or non-systematic. You'll hear all these different terms, and I want to throw them to you simply because you'll see them in this book. Or in another class, you might see one of these words. These are risks that are just that company. So, for example, a good example is Tesla. Tesla, the company, the corporation, moves with the economy up and down. But Tesla also behaves by the rather unusual actions of its CEO. That the actions of the CEO, which cause fluctuations in the company's performance, those are peculiar to that company. They are not part of the system of the world. They're just that company doing that. But then there is the company itself. The company itself behaves with the economy. We can call this systemic risk. It's part of the system itself. It's non-diversifiable. You can't get rid of it by putting this company with other companies. So, for example, Elon Musk can do some pretty crazy things. But then again, there are other electric car companies. They have in their company people who can do crazy things too, companies like Nikola and those other companies that are involved in electric cars and other enterprises. Those peculiarities can cancel each other out because they're not all going to happen at the same time. But there is a systemic part of the risk that is these companies moving with the economy. Measurement. Measurement of systematic risk. Here's the one we use. It's called beta. If a security has no systematic risk, we set its beta at zero. If a security has exactly the same systematic risk as the world economy, then we say beta equals exactly 1.0. We just set them there, and then we measure everything according to that scale. And I'll show you how we actually calculated on Friday. So in other words, treasury bills have beta of zero. A treasury bill has a beta of zero. It has no systematic risk. But I've showed you those things go up and down. Treasury bill yields move. So how can you say it doesn't have risk? I didn't say that. It has no risk that is systematic. It does not react to the world economy. And that's the same way, very quickly here. Let me get this off here. As any company you look at, the beta is not going to tell you how risky it is. It's going to tell you how risky it is in a well-diversified portfolio. We'll pick this up on Friday. That's all I have for you. I thank you.